lot, Luis. Thank you all for coming, and thanks a lot for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here and talk about neutron star mergers today. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on a few what I think are very exciting recent developments, and what I think is a rapidly growing and very exciting intersection of at least three different fields. On the one hand, there's gravitational wave physics and astrophysics, nuclear physics and astrophysics, and then also observational astronomy with electromagnetic waves across the electromagnetic spectrum, and also neutrinos. So this intersection of these different fields was observationally realized for the first time in that recent binary neutron star discovery by Advanced LIGO and Virgo this fall. And in this talk, I'm particularly focusing on these prime targets of the impending era of gravitational wave astrophysics and astronomy, namely neutron star mergers, and how we model them from first principles, and how by modeling those sources from first principles and combining them with the observational data that we have and will have in the future, we can actually learn something about fundamental physics. And one of the very exciting fundamental physics question has been for many decades, what is the origin of the heavy elements in the universe? So we all know the periodic table, but actually to date, we don't yet understand fully where actually most of the elements that are listed in the periodic table actually come from. And in this talk, I'm going to argue that combining first principle simulations, combining some of my recent first principle simulations in combination with the observational data that we now got from the LIGO event, actually for the first time precisely point to an astrophysical site that actually can produce these heavy elements. And that seems, at least at this point in time, at least partially conclude this quest for the cosmic origin of the heavy elements that has been a long-standing mystery for about 70 years. So that's roughly the outline of the talk, what I plan to talk about. So I'll start by making some basic remarks on the R process and also make some historic remarks about the history of the R process. I will then move on and tell you about the state of the art of how we model neutron star mergers from first principles and connect them to observations. That leads me naturally to the topic of mass ejection. So I'll talk about various mechanisms that we know of, that how neutron star mergers can actually lead to the ejection of neutron-rich material into outer space that then naturally provide a source for the R process. This mass ejection can be actually electromagnetically observed, it turns out, in a phenomenon that we call kilonovae. So I'll be discussing a little bit about kilonovae and how we can use these observations to infer something about the nuclear physics. And then I'll bring all of this, all of the above together, and talk to you about what I think is the most promising site for the production of the R process elements in neutron star mergers, in particular in relation to the last event, but also in the view of future detections. And finally, I'll finish with some conclusions and also present some outlook of the next couple of years, which will in which we witness the onset and the beginning of multi-messenger astronomy, including gravitational waves. So as I said, we all know the periodic table. And it has been realized already back in the 40s how the light elements actually form, such as, of course, hydrogen and helium, and also traces of lithium, namely during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So when the universe was only seconds to minutes old. It has then later been realized in the 60s and 70s that actually most of the light elements of lithium, beryllium, and boron actually are produced by spallation, so by interaction of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in the interstellar medium with fast protons from stars. And then, of course, it has been understood for a long while in stellar astrophysics how stars fuse sort of light nuclei to heavy nuclei to form sort of everything up to the iron peak, by which essentially all the nuclear binding energy then is exhausted. That goes even back to ideas of Eddington back in the 1920s. However, the origin of all the rest of these elements heavier than iron has long been a mystery. It has been realized that there are sort of two variants under which you can produce them, and I'll talk about this in some in some detail in a second. So in particular, the S process has been sort of understood, and the astrophysical site has been identified already long ago as well. But all these blue elements, essentially the R process elements, so-called R process elements, has remained a mystery until today. So that brings me to discuss the R process in some detail. And that goes back essentially to the 50s, where independently two groups, Burbage, Fowler and Hoyle, and then independently also Cameron, have essentially realized that all the elements heavier than iron, so say above a mass number of around 60 or so, are essentially need to be formed by neutron capture. And they realized that it is necessary but also sufficient to do this in two ways. You can have two different regimes of neutron capture where you capture free neutrons onto some seed nucleus to form heavier elements. One regime is in which you have the so-called slow neutron capture, or S process, in which the time scale for neutron capture is much longer than for the daughter nucleus than to beta decay. And the inverse, the other regime is essentially where you have rapid neutron capture, or the so-called R process, where the time scale for neutron capture is much shorter than for beta decay. So essentially here you bombard a seed nuclei with a lot of free neutrons, and these daughter nuclei don't have time to actually decay into stable isotopes. So it has been realized essentially that this S process is sort of astrophysically realized in AGB stars on the asymptotic giant band, so in red giants or some subclass of red giants, whereas the rapid neutron capture process has always been sort of a mystery. It has been speculated early on that that may require the explosive environments of supernovae, but we've just learned essentially over the last couple of years that at least ordinary core collapse supernovae are very unlikely to produce heavy R process elements. And that's how neutron star mergers then became a lot more attention. So just to illustrate these two processes real quick, if we look at this in the nuclear chart of proton number versus neutron number, and say we do a slow R process, and say we start with some sort of stable isotope somewhere here, we slowly capture a neutron, and so we move one neutron number to the right and form an isotope with one additional neutron. Now the time scale is much shorter for this, much longer than sort of the time scale for this to decay. So we will just end up producing stable nuclei until we hit an isotope that is unstable against beta decay, that will immediately decay back and bring us sort of one level up in this diagram. So the S process is kind of boring in the sense that it always proceeds along a path of stable isotopes right in the center of the valley of beta stability. So the S process essentially starts capturing slowly capturing neutrons onto sort of iron seed particles, and then moves up along this path. And the R process is much more interesting and exotic in terms of nuclear physics, because here essentially we bombard free seed particles with nucleons, and they don't have the time to decay. So we can move all the way from stable isotopes far away from these stable isotopes to build fairly exotic nuclei. And that's sort of illustrated here by this red path, which is sort of one realization of the R process, where starting from some seed nuclei of iron or so, we can actually move away from this from the center of the valley of beta stability, and then sort of move up and produce all these very exotic nuclei.
So, a quick question.
Yes.
So, have you learned recently, in the past couple of years, that our process doesn't happen?
That's a really good question. I'll come to that towards the end of the talk. It has to do, so there's essentially two lines of argument. There's an observational argument, and there's also a theoretical argument. Okay, just to be really brief, so the observational argument is essentially that the rates at which ordinary core collapse supernovae occur are sort of three orders of magnitude too high. There have been observational indications from plutonium measurements in the deep sea crust that sort of indicate that you need some event that occurs at a fairly low rate but produces a high yield per event. I'll come to that in towards the end of the talk. And the sort of theoretical argument is that in ordinary core collapse supernovae, all the material is exposed to a lot of neutrino radiation, which raises the electron fraction and therefore doesn't really produce neutron-rich initial conditions. So that you can trigger the R process all the way to the second and third R process peak. So initially it was speculated that core collapse supernovae could do this, but then already in the 70s it had been proposed by Latimer and Schramm, actually in a very famous paper, they proposed an idea which then was a very exotic idea, namely that a neutron star merges. So they say here, even in the abstract, the amount of neutron star material ejected into the interstellar medium may be significant, and that this would sort of, this dynamical explosion of neutron-rich matter would sort of provide a natural process for the, natural site for the R process. That was a very exotic idea by that time and didn't get a lot of attention until very recently. Now I make a huge jump in time, and finally we had the LIGO observation last year, where the gravitational wave signal was followed up by a firework of electromagnetic counterparts across the electromagnetic spectrum, starting with a short gamma ray burst 1.7 seconds after the gravitational wave signal, and then with afterglows in the UV optical infrared, which is a transient that we call kilonova, that was indicative of the formation of heavy R process elements for reasons that I'll explain in a few minutes. We've also seen radiation all over the X-rays, even down to the radio, over many orders of magnitude in wavelength. That, I would say, was really a unique event in astronomy. Maybe it's one of the most important observations since supernovae 1987A, which, by the way, was already a multi-messenger observation. But that really, this recent binary neutron star merger detection really put multi-messenger astrophysics to an unprecedented level with tens, decades, or dozens of observing groups following up the event. The nice thing about this merger was it confirmed the association of at least some subclass of short gamma ray bursts with binary neutron star mergers, which has been a long-standing mystery in astrophysics as well. We still don't understand how these jets and how these short gamma ray bursts actually form, but at least we have some observational verification now that there is some link between these events. And then, as I said, in the UV optical infrared, we observed a transient that provided very strong evidence for the synthesis of heavy R process material. So we know that neutron star mergers can produce the heavy elements. So let me, before going into all the details of this and the physics and trying to explain how and where these heavy elements are formed in neutron star mergers, let me talk about the state of the art of how we model these neutron stars from first principles. So it turns out we have actually a very knowledgeable audience here, many neutron star merger people here who are visiting also for the workshop. David is also here. I'm showing here a simulation by David Radice, which just shows a binary neutron star merger that forms fairly rapidly forms a black hole. So let's watch this movie. We see the two neutron stars in spiraling each other, then sort of tidally deforming each other. At some point, they touch and form what we call a hypermassive or supermassive neutron star that at least exists for some amount of time in this simulation here before collapsing to a black hole, which forms now here at the center. And then with material quickly circularizing around this final black hole to form an accretion disk, which will be the main system that I'll be discussing today. You can also have the other option, and that's actually a simulation that I ran with some collaborators last year, where we looked at the other case in which we form actually a long-lived remnant. So we don't promptly collapse to a black hole, but instead we form a long-lived remnant neutron star. So this is showing, again, two neutron stars orbiting each other. We see that material is ejected dynamically from the merger site, and now a long-lived neutron star forms here at the center that gives rise to what we call baryonic winds and pollute the environment with a lot of baryonic material. And I'll talk about this in a little more detail just in a few minutes. So this is just rotating the same simulation by 90 degrees. We now look at the meridional plane again. We see a lot of mass ejection, and the matter that becomes ejected in these ways provides a natural site for the R process. So,
are you going to talk about magnetic fields?
Yes, I'll discuss all about this. So, yes.
So it could be either a heavy neutron star or a black hole.
Yes.
The most massive neutron star we observe is too small.
Right.
2.74, which is the frame measurement of remnant mass, is quite high.
Right.
The
Right. So there's so this is why we call it a hypermassive or supermassive neutron star, because they these objects are typically above the maximum mass for a stable neutron star. Potentially, we don't yet know what the maximum mass of a neutron star really is. We only know for sure that it has to be higher than two solar masses, but we don't know exactly how high that is. But probably for most sort of equations of state that we envision right now, it seems that typically these objects would be higher than that. There may be at least for some distribution of neutrons by the neutron star initial parameters, we may end up actually producing a stable remnant, and that would be a major discovery by LIGO and Virgo within the next couple of years. But typically, it would be a supermassive star. Neutron stars can be prevented from collapsing to a black hole by adding rotation. So there's a limit that is sort of adds another 20% of mass to it by which you can stabilize it just through a uniform rotation. And then by having very complicated rotation profiles, you can even go higher and then at least for dynamical timescales form an object that survives. So which means then tens of milliseconds or so, or maybe even hundreds of milliseconds, depending on the processes that remove angular momentum from the system that we also don't fully understand.
We've never observed a 2.74 solar black hole. That's a very light black hole.
Sure, exactly. So these are fairly light black holes.
No. Because of X-ray barriers. I don't know. What we observe.
If it's over 3, the color of light.
It's under 3. It's possible, but we measure black hole masses through
Right.
Those are subsystems
but,
of conceived.
Right. I don't know it.
Right. But here we essentially have yeah.
RC.
Here we have two objects, so you can.
It's just weird that we're on this band.
Anyways, in order to model these systems from first principles, we need to include a lot of physics in here. And essentially, the punchline is essentially all four fundamental forces come together here somehow, and in a fully coupled regime. So we need, in order to describe the gas and plasma dynamics, we need hydrodynamics, but we also need magnetic fields. Magnetic fields actually, and I'll talk about this in some detail later on, play a crucial role in these systems for various aspects. So we need magnetohydrodynamics. We need to include, of course, gravity. Or general relativity, in this case numerical relativity. We need nuclear physics in order to describe matter at high density, so the equation of state, the behavior, the thermodynamic properties of matter at very high densities, but also then aspects of nuclear physics in terms of production of heavy elements. So we need nuclear reaction network calculations and couple them with the simulations. We need to include weak interactions as well, because during the merger, material is shock heated. So as the two neutron stars come into contact, strong hydrodynamic shock is formed that heats up material to tens of MeV, so weak interactions become important, and neutrinos are copiously emitted from the system, which removes energy and momentum from the system. And it turns out that also neutrino radiation transport is important, because much of this material is semi-transparent. So we have to have at least some approximate way of treating neutrino transport and how the emission of neutrinos, cooling but also heating, affects the dynamics of the system. There's of course additional complications, because the dynamics is very complicated, high degree of rotation. There may be spins in the neutron stars that have to be taken care of. And then of course we have a fluid, so all this dynamics produces fluid and fluid instabilities, like the Kevin-Helmholtz instability or the magnetorotational instabilities. So these are very, very difficult to model in computationally. So this really makes it a full 3D problem. And also then the very challenging aspect is that we have to cover several orders of magnitude, both in space and in time, in order to really link the first principle computation, the first principle modeling, to astronomical observations, to the scales of astronomical observations. So this requires high performance computing. And so in more mathematical terms, what we of course have to do is solve Einstein's equations. And then for the matter part, we of course need to solve the equation of energy momentum conservation. We have to solve Maxwell's equations. Then of course obey mass conservation, so baryon number conservation. And then also we have to keep track of the lepton number evolution. So the source terms on the right hand side just arise because we have weakened actions in the system. We have neutrinos being produced that carry away energy and angular momentum from the system. So our energy momentum tensor is essentially made up of ordinary matter plus electromagnetic fields plus neutrinos. All of this is closed by specifying the thermodynamic properties of the material, what we call the equation of state. And of course, these are tensorial equations on a four-dimensional manifold. So in order to do this computationally, what we do is we have to split space-time in a 3 plus 1 decomposition, where essentially we foliate space-time by levels, so by spatial hypersurfaces that arise as level sets of a function that we call time. And that allows us to transform these equations into a set of partial differential equations, essentially in flat space-time, where we can evolve them sort of with standard mathematical methods for PDE. So we get in the gravity sector something that is called the BSSN equations. And for the matter and fluid part, we get a set of conservation equations that we have to numerically evolve. I base my scientific computing on the so-called Einstein toolkit. And it actually turns out we have the two main developers and maintainers of the Einstein toolkit here in the audience today, which is Eric Schnetter here from Perimeter and Roland Haas, and also other people who've extensively contributed to this, which is a nice high-performance computing platform, essentially to solve partial differential equations for applications in numerical relativity and compact object mergers. And the code that sort of I'm using is defines more or less the state of the art, I would say, in general relativistic MHD simulations that has a very high degree, the highest degree of microphysics included. As a working name, I call it GeoHydro Plus, simply because I don't have a good name for this. This is summarized in a fairly recent paper, Sigmatica 2017b, and there's also another paper on improved numerical schemes to deal with the recovery of conserved and primitive variables, which is sort of the central aspect of this code where all the microphysics comes together. Code is based on GeoHydro, which was originally designed and developed by Philip Mersler and collaborators. It solves the equations of GRMHD in dynamic and fixed space times. We now support realistic tabulated three-parameter equations of state from nuclear physics, so we can directly test nuclear physics calculations in our astrophysical simulations. There's now, as I said, enhanced methods for primitive recovery to support evolved microphysics in the code. There's also new implementation of weak interactions and approximate neutrino transport to keep track of the neutrinos. As I said, this is based on the Einstein toolkit, which provides a space-time solver and all sorts of computational infrastructures. And then, of course, we put them onto big clusters, and then see what the phenomenology of these systems are. So let me come and talk a little bit about what neutron star mergers do astrophysically. So it turns out the neutron star mergers can lead to a fairly rich phenomenology. You can have black hole neutron star mergers that sort of lead to a rather, I would say, boring outcome in which the neutron star is just plunges into the black hole, does not get tidally disrupted, and just forms a remnant black hole, in which none of the baryonic material ends up outside the event horizon. This is, in a sense, a boring event for electromagnetic observations, but also for nuclear synthesis. However, if the black hole manages to tidally disrupt the neutron star, we form a black hole torus system, so some material will sort of circularize inside the event horizon, and then on longer timescales, on viscous timescales of these disks, accrete onto the black hole. And as I'll show in a second, this gives rise to very interesting physics and astrophysics. The same system can be realized from a neutron star-neutron star merger, which leads to a prompt collapse, in which case the disk is not as massive. However, the two neutron stars, as I mentioned earlier, can also form this sort of very heavy clump of material, supermassive or hypermassive neutron star, that at least exists for some amount of time before then collapsing again to a black hole surrounded by some accretion torus, or may even form a long-lived neutron star that can survive on spin-down timescales, depending on the magnetic field strength. That can be minutes, hours, or even days, or maybe even indefinitely stable, and that option is still on the table, and that would be a very exciting discovery by LIGO in the next couple of years to see actually the formation of a magnetar. Of course, all of these outcomes, the precise path depends on the yet unknown equation of state, and of course also on the binary parameters such as the masses, mass ratios, and also spins of the objects.
Can I ask two questions? One is, I mean, the black holes you form from neutron star mergers, would there be a higher spin or lower spin than the ones you get from black hole mergers? Is that,
Usually the spin is sort of, the final spin is sort of dominated mostly by the angular momentum of the orbit of the objects. So unless the individual objects are highly spinning themselves, which for neutron stars is astrophysically not necessarily expected, then you're sort of dominated always by the angular momentum of the orbit. So they should sort of lead to fairly similar spins, unless you have significant spins on the individual objects that sort of can modify or contribute to this.
But you have this disk that accreting,
right?
And it does have a lot of spin, presumably. So if it's, I mean, there is this notion that the accretion spins up the black holes.
You're right. As you were saying, there is more angular momentum in the objects as they touch. If they are stars, if they are black holes, so potentially it could be higher. And well, it depends on the equation of state, but if it is non-spinning black holes coming together, you get 0.67.
Yeah.
If non-spinning neutron stars coming together, you could go up to 0.8.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it can be higher.
Sorry?
They could be pulsars.
Pulsars, yeah. So if we form a long-lived object, then that's actually something I've been working on in the past, trying to come up with models to predict how these objects actually transform into pulsars, and then set up a magnetosphere and a pulsar with nebula even potentially, and that can give rise to very interesting high-energy radiation from the system, and that may be one way of how we can discover the presence of a magnetar in one of the future LIGO events.
So the second question I have was, does the angular momentum transfer, is it primarily by magnetic fields or could it be by neutrinos?
Yeah, so this is actually, so I'll talk about this in great detail because I'm very interested in these accretion disks. It turns out that the magnetic rotation instability plays a major role here in determining the angular momentum transfer, therefore the accretion rate, heating rate, and these kind of things. I'll discuss this in a second. So as I said, we don't yet know the equation of state, so in this sense also LIGO provides us with a laboratory to actually explore the properties of dense matter, parts of at least of the QCD phase diagram that we don't have access to here experimentally on Earth. And that's also very nice and very interesting prospect for the next couple of years. Let me come back to mass ejection. So I apologize for this fairly crowded slide here, but please bear with me as I go through some of the details real quick. So this is supposed to give an overview of all the different mass ejection mechanisms that we know of in neutron star mergers. So that's how we produce neutron-rich material and therefore sites for the R process. So there's this category of dynamical ejector that is typically ejected on sort of millisecond timescales, so on the timescales that are relevant for the merger. They come in two classes. There's tidal ejectors, or material essentially leaking out from the outer Lagrange points of the two stars shortly before mergers, or during the last orbit or so. And then there can be shock heated ejector from the interface. So when the two neutron stars touch, a strong hydrodynamic shock is formed that dumps a lot of kinetic energy and thermal energy and produces strong outflows. Typically what you get is something like 10 to the minus 3 solar masses or so in such an event. That of course depends on the equation of state. And typically this material is moving fairly fast, at least like 20, 30% the speed of light or so. Then later on, if we form such a long-lived remnant neutron star, hypermassive or supermassive neutron star, or even longer-lived, then there will be strong winds from this central remnant for two reasons. On the one hand, we have the weak interactions going on, so strong neutrino radiation that drives thermal winds from the surface of these neutron stars. So-called neutrino-driven winds with typical mass loss rates in this range. A couple of years ago, I've discovered another mechanism by which you can launch winds, which is simply magnetic field amplification in the interior of the neutron star that drives magnetically, that magnetically drives winds that can give rise to even higher mass loss rates. And by combining the two, if you have a large-scale magnetic field, you can potentially even get more mass ejection at higher speeds. And that may be actually required to explain some of the kilonova observation that we recently have seen in the LIGO event. So if you put all of this together, typically in a merger scenario, you end up with something like 10 to minus 3 to 10 to minus 2 solar masses per event. Really, if you stretch it to the limit, you can you may get up to this number. But that is a very strongly, that's an argument that is very much equation of state dependent. And also, of course, it depends on the initial parameters of the system. However, there's a, in this post-merger phase, as I was already alluding to, there's a fairly ubiquitous phenomenon in the sense that there's always material that will circularize around the remnant, be it a black hole or a neutron star. So we'll end up with some sort of accretion disk. And we recently discovered in pioneering numerical relativity simulations of this system, that they are actually extremely efficient in evaporating themselves, in evaporating material into outer space, and providing a natural source, a natural site for the R process. Typically, we find that 30 to 40% of this material that has been circularized around the black hole is essentially evaporated into outer space. Typically, moving at much slower speeds than the dynamical ejector, typically at only 10% the speed of light or so. So in cases where we don't have a prompt collapse, but end up with some sort of accretion disk, we typically find that 10 to the minus 2 solar masses at least are ejected in, through this channel. And why this is something that I'll explain in a little more detail in a couple of minutes. So again, this movie here is showing the simulations that we ran last year is showing the different components. So here you see the dynamical ejector ahead of the winds that then produce that are produced later on. So this is the long-lived remnant, and here we actually have magnetically driven winds. We didn't have neutrinos yet in there in this in the simulation, so these winds are purely magnetic. And
sorry, in that case there was no accretion disk.
There is an accretion disk, so if I go back, sorry, I should have run the movie to the to the end again. So let me see. So here you see that essentially here this is what starts to form an accretion disk. This is still highly dynamical in a very early stage. So these are only like a few tens of milliseconds after merger. But essentially what happens is that all of this stuff here is creating a fairly thick accretion disk, and then once the neutrinos set in, they sort of cool the disk and make it much thinner in the interior. I'll show this in a second. So here, this is again showing the formation of the accretion disk. So you see this movie again. That's David's simulation that nicely shows the formation of the accretion disk from this equatorial plane of view. And this is showing sort of the simulation I did last year, this pioneering simulation with much longer timescales of hundreds of milliseconds, so viscous timescales of the accretion disk, including all the microphysics and nuclear physics that are relevant for the ejection of neutron-rich material into outer space. And
so have you modeled Rayleigh transport for neutrinos?
Yeah, so in this case, I'm only making a very crude approximation to neutrino transport in the sense that it's just a leakage scheme. So here I only account for cooling. And that's for these typical disks, that's a very good approximation because the density is not as high as in the neutron star itself. So actually, this material is optically thin to neutrinos. So what I do is I account for effects of finite optical depth, but it's not really yet a transport problem. You can come into the regime, get into the regime where this becomes optically thick, but then the disk has to be really, really, really massive. Okay, so how do we probe these channels and mass ejection of neutron star mergers observationally? And that brings me to the topic of kilonovae. So as neutron star mergers eject material into outer space through these different channels that I talked about, this neutron-rich material undergoes the R process, so capture of free neutrons onto seed particles to form heavy elements. That's a matter of a second or so. But then on much longer timescales, once we produce all these heavy elements up here, we run out of free neutrons, they have to decay back to the valley of beta stability by beta decaying, alpha decaying. There's also some nuclear fission that's going on here. And that's typically a matter of at least days, where all this nuclear binding energy we release during the radioactive decay is efficiently thermalized in the ejector that makes the ejector glow and produce black body emission that we call kilonova. So the easiest way to think about this, I think, is the following. So just think of a sort of blob of material, spherical blob of material that is sort of homologously expanding into space. And then you can write essentially down an easy equation for the energy, say in a layer of material of this blob. That is essentially, the energetics of this essentially determined by three terms. There's adiabatic losses just due to expansion of the material. Then, as I said, we have radioactive heating from the R process, from all the heavy elements decaying back to stable isotopes and depositing their nuclear binding energy in the material. So there's a heating term here. And then we have a loss term that describes the black body radiation as soon as photons can actually diffuse out of the ejector and produce observable emission. Now, that is controlled by the diffusion time scale, so by the time scale for photons to actually diffuse out of the ejector. And that depends, that of course is determined by the opacity of the material. Now, the opacity, it turns out, is a very complicated, very complicated problem for the following reason. The opacity depends very strongly on the composition of material, so on the type of nuclei that you actually produce in these outflows. So it strongly depends on the nuclear physics that are going on in these outflows. And the reason is the following. So the most important parameter here is what we call the electron fraction, or it's actually a proton fraction. It's the number densities of free protons to all the rest of the baryons that we have in the system. Now it turns out, if you run an R process, if you have a low electron fraction of significantly below a typical value of, say, 0.25 or so, you turn out to form the very heavy elements up to the so-called second and third R process peak. So all the way to mass numbers up to 200 and above, that corresponds essentially to this black curve that is plotted in here. Now, if you instead use an electron fraction that is much higher, or just a little bit higher than 0.25 or so, you end up forming only the light elements, which is indicated here by this blue line. And this regime here, up here beyond the mass number of, say, 130, this is where the lanthanides are formed. So this is like the second to lowest row in the periodic table, and then the actinides, which are even above that. Now, it turns out that if you only produce a small amount of these lanthanide and actinide materials, that they actually dominate the opacities. They have an opacity that is orders of magnitude higher than matter that is at the lower end of the spectrum. And the reason is can be put in a very basic, so the actual details, atomic structure calculations are very complicated, but the argument can be put in a very simple way. It's an atomic physics argument. So if you think about the periodic table and the atomic configurations that these nuclei have, then all the elements up to the second R process peak, up to here, so all these elements essentially have open atomic structures, open atomic shells, D shells and P shells. So they are all sort of in this regime. Now, the dominant opacity for producing optical observable emission that all the astronomers are after right now, this emission is determined by the line expansion opacities in this material. So, by how many atomic line transitions you have in these atoms. Now, you can just by basic combinatorics, you can evaluate like how many electron levels do I have in an atom that has G levels, and you put n electrons in there. Now these opacities, so this is of course not correct and only very approximate, but you can think of that the opacity, line opacity, opacity, essentially a strong function of the number of lines, of the number of lines you have in the atom, and that goes like the level squared. So now if you go from D and P shell atoms to the lanthanides and actinides, which are the rows down here, they have open F shell configurations with a much higher statistical weight, G equals 14, and that leads simply because of this, to an opacity that is at least an order, or maybe in some cases even two orders of magnitude higher. And that's shown here. This plot is showing detailed atomic structure calculations for the line opacity opacities of different elements. So these are iron peak composition elements, so only open D shells and P shells, whereas these are the lanthanides and actinides up here. And you can see that in a good fraction of the wavelength range in the optical and the infrared, these opacities dominate by at least one or two orders of magnitude. And so just based on very basic physics arguments, you could come up with the idea that in principle, these kilonovae, so this mass ejection, should lead to different types of optical transients. Namely, one in which you would not end up producing the very heavy elements, and that would then sort of correspond to a transient that peaks on an earlier time scale and in a sort of shorter wavelength range, so higher frequencies. So typically, this lanthanide free ejector requires sort of low opacity. This requires a high YE to start with, as I explained, and that typically ends up to be in the optical and peaking on sort of a day timescale or so. Whereas if you produce material that has only a tiny fraction of lanthanides in there, you'll have a sort of lanthanide-rich ejector that has a high opacity that requires a low YE to start with, as I explained, and that would then typically peak in the infrared and on a sort of several days to weeks timescale. And the very surprising thing to me was that actually this is exactly what we've observed in this recent binary neutron star merger event. So this is all the data that has been collected from different groups throughout the UV, optical, and infrared with this incredible following up campaign after the LIGO event. So you see different wavelength bands here. This is the UV all the way through the optical to the near infrared. And you actually see here that he has been an early blue transient that has been peaking exactly on a day timescale or so. And the typical masses that have been inferred from these observations is something like a percent of a solar mass at a fairly high velocity of 20 to 30% the speed of light that, as I explained, requires a high electron fraction above 0.25 and sort of a vanishing lanthanide mass fraction, so a low opacity material. On the other hand, we've seen this red transient that has been peaking exactly on a weak timescale, 7 to 10 days or so, and that was even indicative of a lot more mass in this ejecta material, so at least 4 to 5% of a solar mass that is moving slow, therefore, and had high opacities because of the long time scales and the near infrared. So a non-vanishing lanthanide fraction and a slow and a low YE.
Sorry, are you arguing that both of these exist simultaneously, the high lanthanide and not?
Yes. So there's of course a lot of discussion going on as to how many different components are in this data. The easiest way to fit the data is with two components, as I explained here. However, it has been also argued that maybe you can explain it with a single component, so you have sort of a mixing going on and there's only a single component. But it turns out that actually requires a lot of fine tuning. So physically, on physical grounds, you would not expect such a fine tuned scenario that produces a very specific lanthanide fraction for which you need a very precise electron fraction. So the more natural sort of interpretation of this, I would say, is again, based on first principle simulations, we would expect there to be several components that contribute to the overall picture.
Just variations in the electron fraction, you're saying, on like what sort of scales spatially? I mean, I'm not following like why the opacity high at late times, but then low at early times.
Right. So because you can have different mass ejection mechanisms, so this is exactly what my next slide is about. So what I think the a very plausible explanation for this data is the following, in which this early Plu emission peaking on a day timescale or so is actually produced mostly by the shock heated ejecta that originates from the contact interface of the neutron stars as they touch. And then later on, sort of added by winds from a hypermassive or supermassive neutron star remnant that ejected massive winds that are typically Plu because there's a lot of neutrino radiation that raises the electron fraction. So this requires sort of a metastable neutron star phase and also an equation of state with a fairly small neutron star radius to enhance the amount of shock heated ejecta here. So that, to me, is the fastest moving material that sort of originates first, has a fairly high electron fraction. And then on later time, at later times, on longer time scales.
Why would it have a high electron fraction?
Okay, so the high electron fraction comes about because as soon as the material touches, so as soon as the two neutron stars come into contact and kinetic energy becomes thermalized, you trigger neutrino emission. And these neutrinos weakly interact with the material and raise the electron fraction. So the electron and positron capture rates onto neutrons and protons are then shifted. So the equilibrium of these two competing of positron and electron capture, the equilibrium value of this of these reactions is sort of shifted towards higher towards higher YE, because you start off with neutron-rich conditions in the first place. So positron capture is much more preferred than electron capture. So the neutrino radiation and the interaction of neutrinos with the surrounding material raise the electron fraction, and that's why you end up typically with something that is above 0.25, which is the threshold to produce lanthanides and actinides. So you end up with fairly low opacities.
Are you saying that the bulk of the neutron stars after they collide rises to this kind of electron fraction?
The way to think about this is that the neutrinos that are emitted from the central source, from this hypermassive neutron star, interact with outflows that they are producing at the same time, and they are partially reabsorbed in this outflow, and that raises and the weak interactions in this outflow raises the electron fraction above typically something like 0.25.
The outflow that has
yes, the yes, and then later on, you have this accretion disk that can unbind even much more material, moving at slower speeds, and giving rise to a fairly high opacity material, which produces the red ejector. Yes.
So there you have the amount of ejector from the accretion disk is a lower bound. I was wondering why it's a lower bound and what kind of parameters.
Right. Yeah. Really good question. So this is assuming typical disk masses of say 10%, 20% of a solar mass, which are sort of typical accretion disk masses in the aftermath of a neutron star merger. Now, of course, in the case where you have a prompt collapse, where you immediately form a black hole, much of the material may actually end up in the black hole. So you may not form an accretion disk that is as massive as this. But I'm sort of arguing now that in this case, at least of this recent binary neutron star merger, a very massive accretion disk must have formed of at least 10% of a solar mass or so. Because the outflows from this accretion disk, as I'll argue in a second, actually fairly nicely explains the observations. And is to me, at least at this point in time, the only really plausible explanation for really slow-moving, high opacity, very massive ejecta.
Why does the accretion disk have such a low electron fraction? Do you know why, or is it a fit?
I'll come to this. There's very interesting physics going on in there, and I'll mention this in a second. So I think, just to wrap up on this idea, I think a very plausible scenario for this recent LIGO event is something that two neutron stars that produce such a hypermassive neutron star that at least survives for some amount of time before then collapsing to a black hole torus system with an accretion disk. Okay, so coming to the actual side of the R process and why the accretion disk actually can produce the heavy elements that we've observed in this event. So in order to understand this, let's look in a little bit more detail into the physics of these accretion disks. And what I'm going to show you on the next slide is a few quantities that I obtained by averaging radially over this box, which turns out to contain the dynamically most important part of the accretion disk, where the sort of location of the maximum density is. So I and plot them sort of as a function of time, so I get space-time diagrams. So in the upper panel, I'm showing actually the y component of the magnetic field. So that's the toroidal component of the magnetic field, so the component of the magnetic field in the disk plane. And as I said, as a function of time and as a function of height. So this is the equatorial plane, so the mid-plane of the accretion disk. And as you can see, this is what astrophysicists call essentially a butterfly diagram. So this is fairly similar to sunspots in the sun, for example, in stellar astrophysics. So this is the signature of a dynamo that is going on here in the disk. So you can see that there's magnetic energy being generated in the disk midplane by MHD turbulence, by MRI, magnetorotation instability, and then by magnetic buoyancy and pressure gradients, these magnetic field sort of slowly migrates off the midplane to higher latitudes, where it then gradually dissipates into heat and contributes to forming what I call a hot corona that's indicated here by the specific entropy of this accretion disk. So you can see that here at these higher latitudes, a lot of entropy actually sort of acquires. And the reason for that is the following. These accretion disks are a little bit different. So there's interesting nuclear physics going on here. They're different than many other accretion disks in astrophysics in the sense that they actually cooled from the midplane. The main cooling agent here are neutrinos. And this plot here shows the neutrino emissivity. And you can see the weak interactions very strongly track the density of the material. So the neutrinos are most efficiently radiated away from the disk midplane. And then the emissivity falls off fairly sharply to the higher latitudes. So in these upper regions, in these high latitude regions, essentially, the viscous heating that is generated by angular momentum transport in the disk and sort of created by MHD turbulence is not balanced anymore by cooling, simply because the cooling agent is missing in these parts. So this contributes to forming this hot corona. So there's a lot of thermal energy dumped there that then generates thermal outflows. And that's exactly how these disks evaporate their material and produce neutron-rich material. So the question is now, this is sort of the physical launching mechanism of the material. The question is, why is this neutron-rich? And why does that produce the heavy elements? And I'll come to this in a second, just noting that the typical disk winds, they're ejected at something like 10% the speed of light, or something that we get out of the simulation. And the physical explanation for the slow material is the following. Typically, these hot coronae lift the material out of the potential of the black hole and only unbind it marginally. But then what boosts the material is actually sort of a nuclear rocket where you where free nucleons, protons and neutrons, recombine to form seed particles for the R process and thereby release nuclear binding energy release. And that becomes available in specific enthalpy, which is then converted into kinetic energy. And so if you sort of roughly estimate how much nuclear binding energy you have per baryon, that ends up to be a number of around 8 MeV per baryon. So if you convert that to a velocity scale, you get exactly 10% the speed of light. So that sets a natural velocity scale for these outflows and explains why these accretion disks actually launch fairly slow winds, precisely actually what we observe in the observations, 10% the speed of light. So now the question is, why are these outflows neutron-rich? Why do they produce the heavy elements? Because naively, you would assume that starting off with some neutron-rich material in the first place, which is what we do in neutron star mergers, that sort of positron capture, which is what I was mentioning earlier, positron capture onto free neutrons dominates over electron capture of protons, simply because we have more neutrons available. So you would expect the material to protonize over time. So that should raise the electron fraction of the material and therefore raise also the opacity of the outflow material. And that's actually what's happening in the outer parts of the accretion disk. So I'm plotting this here for different times. This is the electron fraction. And you can see how the electron fraction over time significantly rises in the outer parts of the accretion disk. So the non-trivial question to ask is, why actually over viscous timescales, over the evolution timescales of the accretion disk, why does the outflow stay neutron-rich? And you can see that the answer lies essentially the inner part of the accretion disk. And there's interesting physics going on here, which I'll point out in this slide here. So what we found here in these simulations is actually a non-trivial feedback mechanism, a negative feedback mechanism that by which the accretion disk self-regulates itself into a state of low, of high neutron richness, so low YE values. And the argument is the following. So the main two energetic agents here in the system that act on the material are, on the one hand side, viscous heating from MHD turbulence that sets the accretion rate and sets the heating rate of the material. But on the other hand, cooling through weak interactions. And these are all the reactions that I track in the simulation. So you have the charge current processes, electron positron capture, pair annihilation, and plasma decay, all of which sort of produce neutrinos.
So what is plasma decay?
So these are gammas, photons that spontaneously decay at very high temperatures. And if you have these two sort of energetic processes arguing with each other, and they are roughly balanced, you get the following negative feedback mechanism. So imagine we put the electrons in this material into a degenerate state. We push the electrons into a degenerate state, and most of these electrons are actually locked up in the Fermi C. So we can only access the electrons that are around the Fermi edge that can be thermally excited out of the Fermi C. So we actually end up with much fewer electrons and positrons that can weakly interact with the material. That means, going back to these processes here, that with fewer electrons and positrons, we produce, of course, less neutrinos. So there's less cooling. And with less cooling, we raise the temperatures. But that, again, lowers the normalized chemical potential of the electrons. So whenever we push the electrons into a highly degenerate state, they tend to oppose and regulate themselves back into a state where sort of both of these mechanisms are roughly balanced. And that leads to a mild electron degeneracy. So this is plotted here in the lower panel, where you can see that sort of this normalized chemical potential mu over kt is of the order of 1 in the inner parts of the disk, so the inner sort of 100 kilometers or so. And that goes together with a low YE, which you can show under these conditions. So the neutron, so these post-merger accretion disks keep a reservoir of neutron-rich material in the inner parts of the accretion disk that continuously feeds neutron-rich material into the outflow to keep the overall electron fraction of the outflow significantly below 0.25 to actually produce heavy R-process elements. And that's shown here in this movie, where I'm showing a fluid element as it's ejected from this post-merger accretion disk into outer space as it undergoes the R process. So we start off with, so this is again in the plane of proton number versus neutron number. And so we start off with seed nuclei that are stable isotopes, of course, up to iron or so, at the center of the valley of beta stability. And then we start the movie. We start. So this fluid element is sort of moving out now through the hot corona. So you see some oscillations, that is turbulence in the hot corona, and then at some point it moves away from the accretion disk and decompresses, cools down, and then at some point we reach a threshold temperature, which is typically a few gigakelvin, where we run out of nuclear statistical equilibrium. So all the nuclear reactions get out of equilibrium, and that's where we start to capture the free neutrons onto these seed nuclei. And start the R process, which is now starting. So now we capture free neutrons onto these three particles to form all the heavy elements up to very high mass numbers. Now we run out of free neutrons, and all these elements have to decay back to form stable isotopes on much longer timescales then. And this being a statistical ensemble of nuclei with all with different decay timescales, sort of superimpose to a power law heating rate. So typically something like T to the minus 1.3, which is exactly also the heating rate that you get from nuclear waste, interestingly, simply because it's a statistical ensemble of nuclei with different decay properties. And that nuclear binding energy is exactly what's heating up the material and producing the optical emission that astronomers have observed after the LIGO event. Now, that was just a single fluid element. What does it mean for the overall R process reduction in the outflow from these post-merger accretion disks? That's shown here in these two plots. Here I'm comparing the relative abundances that I get from full nuclear reaction network calculations to observed abundances in the solar system, shown as dots here. And here I make a comparison with measurements of heavy elements in metal poor stars in the halo of the of our own Milky Way. As you can see, the results from the simulation actually fairly nicely very nice agreement with the observational data. And that indicates that we can sort of, with this process, form all the R process elements all the way from the so-called first peak to the third peak. Now, putting all this together, again, and coming back to this earlier question on Kalkhoff supernovae, we can now sort of summarize our knowledge about the R process and potential R process sites in this diagram, where the way to think about this is sort of plotting a potential R process enrichment event, just being agnostic about the actual astrophysical process. The yield of that R process enrichment event, so the ejected mass as a function of the rate of this R process enrichment event. We know from astronomical observations how much R process material roughly there is in our own galaxy. And of course, there's a degeneracy between, so in order to get a certain amount of R process material, there's a degeneracy between, you can either do this with a high yield, low rate event, or you can do this with a high rate, low yield event. So you get sort of get this line, which I plotted here as a black line. Now, LIGO has actually measured the binary neutron star merger rate. So we actually know with error bars, essentially, where this rate for neutron star merger would lie. You see that the Kalkhoff supernovae actually lie over here at a much higher rate. There have been recent measurements of this plutonium isotope 244 in the deep sea crust, and also from measurements from the pre-solar system abundances that sort of indicate that there's this yellow sort of field in which the R process, the potential R process enrichment event has to lie in. And that clearly points to something like a high yield, low rate event, and this clearly disfavors core collapse supernovae. Now, we know, we can now also add what we know from numerical simulations. We know that dynamical ejecta are typically probably in this range between something 10 to minus 4 to 10 to minus 2 solar masses if you really stretch it to the limit. And we can plot also the disk ejecta, which I got from my simulations, which should, at least in the case where you form massive accretion disks, would lie on top of those up here. And you can see that all these constraints essentially nicely come together in this region. Sort of course, there are still major uncertainties, but there's tentative evidence, of course, that all these sort of constraints and findings from simulation sort of converge onto that spot in this diagram, and that therefore these post-merger accretion disks seem to be actually a fairly promising site to produce the heavy elements.
What is the idea? Why does that measurement of plutonium in the ocean crust put that constraint?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So plutonium is a heavy R process element, and therefore probes the production of the sort of second to third peak R process elements. And what's been done is essentially that a couple of years ago, they have measured plutonium abundances in the deep sea crust. I believe it was somewhere in New Zealand or so. And we also have a measurement of the plutonium abundance from sort of pre-solar system measurements from meteorites. And there's actually, it turns out there's a large scatter between these measurements. So now you can do some modeling by which you sort of assume either a high rate, low yield event, or you can assume something like a high yield, low rate event. And then you would typically assume that if you have an enrichment event that occurs at a high frequency, sort of because the plutonium radioactively decays with a certain decay time scale, you sort of get a spiky production of these heavy elements. Whereas, for example, in this case, you have much rarer events. So you have a spike and then sort of a decay, and then you have a spike and a decay. Of course, this has to be convoluted with the mixing time scale in the galaxy. And so you have to do some precise modeling of this. But sort of the bottom line being the fact that in a high yield, low rate event, simply because it's less frequent, you would assume a larger scatter of these measurements relative to something that is a high frequency event. And this sort of this large scatter was sort of not compatible with the picture of having something frequent and low yield. So that's roughly the
two observed measurements of the turning.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
The reseller system. And
yes, that's my understanding. Yes. Yeah.
What's the third yellow line through the middle there? I'm not sure I understand.
Sorry, this one. So okay, this is just the range of different models. So this sort of just indicates the uncertainty in these measurements.
It's between them.
Exactly. It has to be between these two lines.
Okay.
Of course, there's huge uncertainties here, cosmological uncertainties here. But that is something that we will do with much, much higher precision in the next 5 to 10 years, especially also if we have better nuclear data from facilities like TRIOMPHE in Canada, but also EFRIP at Michigan State, which is being built right now. So we can get much more reliable values from the simulations, but also we will have much more observations of the binary neutron star merger rate, and then and fairly soon, and also neutron star black hole mergers, hopefully, that will help us to understand this much better.
But there's some assumption you're making about like the mixing within the ISM.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to.
Like, I mean, how do you have any constraint on that? I guess.
To be honest, I don't do these models, right? So this is astronomers do these models, and there's a mixing scale from the galaxy that you have to assume that you can get from galactic rotation rates and these kind of things. So there's some assumption that you have to make here, there's significant uncertainty in these models.
I think it's based on abundance of cosmic rays at various isotopes of cosmic rays, so different diffusion could be a different ratio of abundances.
But if I have like one supernova going off here versus 10 supernova going off here, I mean, how do I know how to predict how much plutonium is occurring in these?
So you sort of populate the galaxy essentially more or less evenly with these events, and you assume sort of a certain event rate and a typical yield.
The volume over which the pre-solar nebula drew from.
Yes.
No idea.
Right.
On that volume, so I don't see how I can draw any line.
Yeah, I mean these are sort of one zone models in which you sort of assume that the whole galaxy is like. Is being mixed, so you just populate it with different sources, and then you sort of assume a mixing time scale over which is a sort of all mixed, and then you assume that simply all sort of solar systems would sort of collapse from this material and then form something.
But if you had a lot of events that were contributing to the solar nebula.
Right.
Over, wouldn't that look a lot like the high rate, low yield?
If I knew what the volume that I drew from was, right? So if mixing was large, I drew from some huge volume, there's many supernovae contributing.
Mm-hmm.
But if the volume that I drew from was really tiny, then. Right.
For some elements, it's larger, and for some elements, it's. But I guess the idea is that, yes, if there's one universal diffusion constant for all the cosmic rays. And I think that's the simplification that goes in there.
Yeah. So there's a lot of improvements on the modeling as well that we need to understand, and how this really factors into the global sort of chemical evolution of galaxies, but also in of the universe as a whole. And that's something that's very exciting that we can address say in the next 5-10 years. So just to make the point, I would never show an abstract, but I think the very funny and surprising aspect to me about all this was that I published the first results of these simulations of these post-merger accretion disks just a couple of months. So it was actually published after, but submitted earlier. a couple of months just before the LIGO event. So we actually made, so this is actually first principle theoretical prediction, that where we concluded that these post-merger accretion disks should be a robust second to third peak R process site, and that they would be a very important site for the R process. Now then the LIGO event happened in August, and it was just mind-blowing to me that that it seemed that was actually what occurred in this LIGO event. So Stefan Roswalk, who was actually one of the pioneers of this idea that neutron star mergers produce heavy R process elements in the universe, so he did the first first SPH simulations in the early 2000s or so, and yeah, end of the 90s, early 2000s. He wrote a very nice viewpoint article on this in physics, a non-technical article, which I highly recommend. Anyways, this brings me to the conclusions. So as I said, the origin of the heavy elements has been an enduring mystery for at least 70 years, going back to the work back in the 50s, where based on first meteorite measurements, sort of independent groups concluded that the R process should produce the heavy elements. I hope I could convince you that we really need first principle simulations. These are really key to understand the formation and to identify the site for the production of heavy elements, and that putting together simulations, first principle simulations with gravitational wave observations, and especially also the electromagnetic follow-up, the kilonova signal, can actually point precisely to an R process site. As I was saying, these post-merger accretion disks would be a fairly ubiquitous phenomenon. So one sort of proposition for the future, one expectation is that also in the future LIGO events, we should see accretion disk, and we should see this low red ejector producing strong kilonova signal in the near infrared and ejecting a lot of material into outer space. As I said, the mechanism to do this is the hot corona that we found, the dry thermal outflows. And that is actually potentially the dominant site for most neutron star merger ejector, for most neutron star mergers. It's much slower than a dynamically ejector, so that's the sort of smoking gun for this. So putting together all the relative abundances that we get from the simulations, together with the total ejector mass that we get from astronomical observations, plus the measured binary neutron star merger rate that we have now from LIGO, from the gravitational waves, I think gives us the strongest evidence that neutron star mergers are actually indeed the prime production site for R process elements. And I don't know if I have still a minute or so, I would go on and just tell you in a few words what I think is the outlook for the next couple of years for the impending era of multi-messenger astronomy. So within the next 5 to 10 years, we will see a revolution in time domain astronomy. And that is, of course, mainly driven by gravitational wave observations as well. So by 2020, we can now predict from the measured binary neutron star merger rate that we will have something like 6 or say 10 to 120 events per year. So we can start looking at these events in a really statistical sense. We will have also improved sky localization from the gravitational waves as this detector of networks will be enlarged by LIGO India, potentially in the early 2020s, by CAGRA, which is presently scheduled to join in 2020. And this is paralleled by, as I said, a revolution in time domain astronomy. So we will have major facilities joining this effort in the next couple of years. LSST, starting in 2020, will hopefully help us to identify optical counterparts. They have the sensitivity to do this throughout the gravitational wave sensitivity volume. So for any sort of reasonable kilonova signal, we will be able to catch this kilonova counterpart and learn something about our process elements. There will be JWST starting hopefully 2019, or shortly after, thereafter, which will provide exquisite near-infrared kilonova spectroscopy. So we can start asking questions of actually proving the composition of the material and starting to make statements on the presence of certain R process elements in the ejector. And that will be also for us, for first principle modeling, will be a very challenging task. Then there may be WFIRST joining in the early 2020s, which will provide also unprecedented infrared temporal monitoring. So that's not. No, not yet.
Trump wants to.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. Okay, and then of course, what I'm also very excited about is nuclear astrophysics, of course. Joining TRIOMPHE here in Canada, which will already look into many of the R process nuclei over the next couple of years, we will have EFRIP joining in 2022, a major facility built at Michigan State right now that is specifically designed to measure all the nuclear properties of heavy R process nuclei, so beta decay rates, neutron capture rates, and these kind of things. So we'll actually have precise experimental data so that we can start doing sort of precision R-process modeling with our astrophysical simulations and compare them to all the data from the time domain astronomy efforts. And of course, we also have, what I'm also excited about is neutrino physics. Of course, we will have facilities. iSCOOP is already online. There will be Antares and maybe future follow-up experiments in the early 2020s to look for neutrino signals of these mergers. So what I hope to learn, essentially, just in terms of nucleosynthesis, there's many other aspects. But in terms of nucleosynthesis, I think I'm very excited to learn about in the next 5 to 10 years. Are neutron star mergers really the dominant side of our process? Elements in the universe. What is the contribution of neutron star black hole mergers? Another breakthrough discovery of LIGO that will most likely happen over the next couple of years. What is the range and diversity of synthesized elements? So is this all solar composition? Are there some surprises that we may see there? Can we actually see spectroscopically in the near infrared or so the synthesis of specific elements? And that may actually be very interesting because it seems that the slow disk wind ejecta have fairly slow velocity so that the lines are not broadened too much. So we may be able to do some spectroscopy and see if we can identify individual elements. Then a very interesting question is, of course, can we actually prove that certain lanthanides and actinide elements are formed, especially the actinides? There's also astronomical sort of phenomenon of actinide boost stars, where it seems that actinides are actually overproducing these stars. That's also a big mystery to explain how you only produce actinides, but essentially you don't produce enough lanthanides. How does this actually factor into the light curves? How is the interaction? What is the interaction between the different outflow components? We need to do three-dimensional kilonova light curve modeling from first principles, really, to decipher all the range and diversity of events that we'll have over the next couple of years. And then, of course, the final big picture question is, of course, how does all this factor in and explain the chemical evolution of individual galaxies, but also as the of the universe as a whole? And I think the really important thing in here, we will have a lot of observational data coming from all sides, but in order to really understand the physics and astrophysics of this, we need first principle modeling, and I hope I could convince you about this. So these first principle modeling will sort of also act as a bridge between sort of nuclear physics and experimental facilities, and then of course also fundamental physics with gravitational waves, but of course also astronomy as a large. And finally, there's of course many, many other aspects of these problems, of these transient and of the upcoming era of multi-messenger astronomy. Just to point out a few individual aspects that I'm very excited about, that I've also worked on in the past a lot, and that I will also of course be working on in the future, and which may turn out to be important models or predictions for the upcoming observations. One aspect that I'm very excited about is, of course, how do astrophysical jets form? How do short gamma ray bursts form? That's a question, a mystery that has been around for decades. We don't really know in astrophysics how jets really form. What are the microphysical processes that do that? And neutron star mergers now, with all the observations that we will get, provide us with a unique opportunity to actually study this. Then, of course, one exciting discovery will be the formation of a long-lived neutron star, probably a magnetar. So it will be interesting to learn in what fraction of events this occurs. What does that mean in terms of the maximum mass of a neutron star and constraining the equation of state? What are the electromagnetic signatures of this? Maybe we create something like a pulsar wind nebula. That's something that I've speculated about in the past that would give rise to very interesting high energy emission, and that would have profound implications also for other fields of astrophysics, so supernova remnants and these kind of things, because here we could actually see something like this forming in real time, just on much smaller length scales and time scales. Of course, in order to sort of model all this and make the connection to all these astrophysical aspects, we need to really understand the behavior of matter at the extreme, meaning under a strong gravity, strong dynamical gravity, strong magnetic fields, extreme thermodynamic conditions, subject to fluid instabilities, rapid rotation. So this needs to be modeled in a self-consistent way. Of course, there's many aspects of neutrino physics and weak interactions. Maybe we'll see non-thermal neutrinos in the future, and it'd be very important, of course, to include this in first principle modeling. I'm also very excited about neutrino oscillations. It may be that we can actually, with the kilonova observations, look for smoking guns to identify whether neutrino oscillations have been this discovery of the fast flavor conversions over the last couple of years, which may imprint itself into the kilonova signal. And there may be ways to actually look for fundamental neutrino physics in the observations. And finally, of course, I'm of course also very excited to learn about to see if we can learn something at least about part of the QCD phase diagrams. So in the context of the equation of state, and see if we can sort of tap this new physical regime that we get here with the neutron star mergers to learn something about the behavior of matter at ultra high densities and at fairly high temperatures. And I think since time is up, I should really stop here. And if you have any questions, then I'm more than happy to answer. Thanks. Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's the alignment angle with the sort of orbital plane. There are two ways essentially where we can get some information from on the one hand from the gravitational waves themselves. But on the other hand, we also have really good indications from the electromagnetic observations. So we've observed the afterglow of this very weak short gamma ray burst across several orders in wavelength in the electromagnetic spectrum. So all the way from the X-rays down to the radio. And we've seen synchrotron afterglow emission right now over hundreds of days. Actually, there's been very recent observations in early January that now indicates that we have a perfect power law of all the way from the X-rays over to the optical, all the way down to the radios, lies sort of perfectly on a power law slope. So there's very nice a synchrotron afterglow radiation from this, and then sort of fitting models for a relativistic blast wave for a jet, we can sort of from the peak time scale and the shape of this of these afterglow light curves from all the way from the X-rays down to the radio, we can sort of infer the geometry to some extent and nicely. These two sort of ways of estimating this sort of nicely agree, at least within error bars. Of course, it's a sort of a crude measurement, but at least we have some indications that this misalignment angle is something about like 20 to maybe even 30 degrees or so.
So you mentioned about this alpha, which has this characteristic speed of 0.1 c, and you're saying it's related to the binding energy. So does magnetic field or neutrinos also play a role in this post-mergers as well?
In setting the velocity, you mean? Sure. So, I mean, the magnetic fields play a crucial role because the magnetic fields are actually producing this hot corona. So, because they mediate the angular momentum transport and the heating rate, and they sort of provide the corona with a lot of thermal energy. And that lifts the material out of the potential in the first place and also unbinds it to some extent. But typically, this would be then only of the order of maybe. Something like a few percent of the speed of light at most, but then sort of this nuclear the nuclear recombination energies then boost this sort of by a significant factor that is at least on the same order of magnitude to end up at something like 10% of speed of light. So you don't get 10% like always because that depends on the precise way of how you form these seed particles. So not every baryon will definitely lose 8 MeV per baryon and contribute all of this just in the acceleration of the wind. But a significant fraction of this, that's at least what we find in the simulation, ends up accelerating the outflow, because some of this recombination can also occur at later times when most of the outflow is already sort of accelerated and diluted, and then sort of the efficiency with which you convert this binding energy into kinetic energy is much less decreased. So it only sets like a characteristic scale, but it does not mean that it's responsible for the entire velocity that we see.
Yeah, because you were mentioning these magnetic driven winds,
yes,
from these hypermassive, yeah, could have higher speed.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So in the case in which we have a neutron star in the center or so, you can also imagine that scenario, right, where we have a neutron star and it's strongly magnetized. And here the physics is a little bit different, because if we have large scale ordered magnetic field structures that are fairly strong, then they can sort of help to unbind material fairly fast. So they can sort of help just the neutrino mechanism, which is one of the main mechanisms of unbinding material there, to accelerate material. And then at some point, also the nuclear recombination will set in and further accelerate this material. But that is something that we still need to study. So we haven't done yet really fully detailed simulations on this. But that's also, of course, a regime we have to probe.
Is there any prospect for measuring any of the actual standard model parameters in the neutrino sector from these? Like I was mentioning, you mentioned these fast neutrino oscillations.
Yeah.
There's this parameter which basically hasn't been measured so far, that the CP violating phase and electrons in the neutrino sector, which makes neutrinos oscillate differently from antineutrinos. Is
right.
That sort of thing that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if we find so this is something. These are ideas now that are not well shaped yet. So if we find some imprint of this in the nuclear synthesis and in the electromagnetic observations of this, then we may be able to address these kind of things. But we still need to look for a sort of smoking gun to sort of identify this. But potentially, yeah. I mean, it's not impossible, I guess.
So if we accept this model that the kilonovas line us, that there's this sort of slow component of ejected material, like 4 or 5% of the solar mass, and it is coming from the accretion disk.
Right.
Is that number telling us something about the properties of the neutron stars, their masses, or their equations of state, or is it fairly insensitive to those things, or is that an open question?
It's a really good question. So largely, it's insensitive to many aspects of the equation of state. It turns out that the most important parameter going in here is whether or not you sort of promptly collapse to a black hole, and that's closely linked to the tidal deformability parameter. So actually, David has done some nice simulations where he's essentially showed that if you have a tidal deformability parameter that is below a certain value, you tend to promptly collapse into a black hole and therefore end up only with fairly light accretion disks. So they may not be as massive as this one. But once you're above this regime, essentially independent of the equation of state, you end up with disk masses that are fairly high. So typically 10, 20% of a solar mass. And that's sort of a two-level regime. And we don't know yet from the point of the equation of state where we actually lie in this regime. But since we've observed already one, and if we accept that this originates that this slow outflow component originates from post-merger accretion disk, then this is at least tentatively some evidence that we actually lie in this latter regime, in which we typically produce fairly high accretion disk masses.
Okay, let's thank David again.
Sure, thank you.